Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With your host, Frank Thompson.
Hello and welcome to episode 58 of the Commentary Track. This is part two of my interview with Matthew Kennedy, author of a great new book, Roadshow, The Fall of Film Musicals in the 1960s. I'm your genial host, Frank Thompson, who dreams the impossible dream, who fights the unbeatable foe, who wakes up disappointed and who loses that fight. And yet, I make another podcast anyway. So I'm glad that you're here, and I hope you listened to part one. If you didn't, stop what you're doing. Stop everything. Go listen to the first part of this podcast, episode 57, and that'll catch you up to speed. Right now, we're picking up. We just finished talking about Joan Blondell, and that turned out to be a great bridge because Matthew wrote biographies of both Joan Blondell and director Edmund Goulding, and one of Goulding's best, most interesting features is called Nightmare Alley, which stars Tyrone Power and Joan Blondell. And so that was a great segue to go straight from Joan Blondell to Edmund Goulding. And then we go on to talking about the Roadshow book. And all that stuff is real interesting because that's an era that has always fascinated me as well, that all these studios just bloated on the success of Sound of Music and Mary Poppins, and My Fair Lady, which is a huge hit. And all the studios thought, well, that's what you do. That's how you do it. You just make a huge multi-million dollar blockbuster musical and the world will beat a path to your door. And it turned out to nearly ruin Hollywood because they were putting out stuff like Man of La Mancha and so forth. Dr. Doolittle. Ew, boy. Anyway, it's a fascinating story, and the book is beautifully written and very engaging, as all of Matt's writing is. So here we are for part two of my interview with Matthew Kennedy, and I'll see you on the other side. Well, you mentioned Nightmare Alley, which is a film that is almost a class by itself, especially for the time it was made, mm-hmm. with Tyrone Power as eventually a circus geek.
That's right.
Geek does not mean there what it means now.
Yeah, I try to avoid that word these days because I just can't get Nightmare Alley out of my head.
tell the listener who doesn't know what a geek is.
A geek was a circus act when, you know, the sort of second-rate circuses would travel around the country. And a geek was someone who was usually, according to the novelist who wrote Nightmare Alley, a circus geek was someone who was paid with booze or drugs, mm-hmm. you know, maybe not even necessarily cash, to bite the heads off chickens. And, you know, people would pay to see this. And
you got to admit, it's a great act.
Yeah. The Lovett and Peoria, right? Sure. So geek has been redefined as just somebody who's, I think, almost synonymous with nerd.
Yeah.
I use the word nerd a lot. I really don't use the word geek, but yeah. They seem to be almost interchangeable today, but not back then.
I've always wondered if there was a geek who really was striving for the big time and was biting the heads off turkeys or
emu,
ostriches. You know, he really wanted
to take
it to the next level. but the director of that film, Goulding, is someone who also got... Now, did you come to Goulding? You came to him before Blondell, right?
That's right. So Nightmare Alley is sort of my bridge movie, right? Because Goulding directed that. Goulding was the second book after Dressler, and then Blondell. And so I devote a fair amount of time in the Goulding book to Nightmare Alley. It gets a whole chapter. And it was before it was out on DVD, so it was still not that well known.
Yeah.
It had not gone out back into public circulation. And I fell in love with it and thought, you know, this really enriches my understanding of Goulding's career because it stands alone not only for its subject matter and the way it treats circus acts and the geek and how it treated Tyrone Power's career and what he thought of it, but also that Goulding was it's singular in Goulding's career. He never did anything remotely like Nightmare Alley before or since. As it's gritty, grimy. It's usually categorized as film noir, but it's not even, it doesn't even necessarily possess the so-called typical trappings of noir. I mean, we don't have a private detective. We don't have guns. We don't have shocking revelations other than the degradation of a human.
There's a spiritual darkness to Nightmare Alley.
Yeah.
That I think people call it noir simply because they can't figure out what else to call it.
Well, and it's shot darkly.
Yeah.
You know, and brilliantly.
Yeah.
So it has that in common, I suppose. But, you know, when the term noir was coined later, you know, I wonder if Nightmare Alley started being forced into that category, as you say, because it doesn't really have.
No, there's no genre that really captures it.
Where else do you put it? Or do you just call it a singular movie?
But when you look at a movie like that, just visually, doesn't it make you just want to thump people who won't watch black and white films?
Yes.
Doesn't it kill you stupid these people are? And because it's such a gorgeous looking movie. And so many of those films of that, especially once you get to the 40s, where I think it's the flowering of studio lighting.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly the 30s has some beautiful stuff, of course. But the 40s is when it seemed to go into a Baroque period of just this incredible lighting and photography. It just kills me that people are so blind to that stuff.
Right. Or just say, I'm not going to watch it because. And I'll tell you, I mean, there are very, very, very few movies I have ever seen that were in black and white that I wished were in color.
Yeah.
I don't miss color. I mean, Nightmare Alley is a fully realized.
Yeah.
Perfect. Not perfect, but it's a great thing, and it's great in part because of its photography. And black and white is absolutely essential.
And conversely, I've seen many color films that I thought would have worked better in black and white.
Yes, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
You know, most recently, The Dark Knight. I was watching that.
Oh, yeah. A friend of mine watched They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Recently. And he turned off the color. Because it's a gritty, grimy, downbeat, depression era.
Sure.
Drama, right? Done in 1969, so it's going to be widescreen color. He decided to turn off the color, and he said, oh my God, it's an even better movie in black and white. And I thought, you know, I'll bet it is, given the subject and how it was treated. Now I want to see it and turn off the color.
Nowadays, even when people make black and white films, and it does happen now and again. I mean, Nebraska is a current example.
Right.
And also, Nebraska is one of the first films I've seen in a long time. What I was about to say was, they shoot it usually digitally anyway, so they're shooting it in color, and then just bleeding the color out to make black and white prints, or black and white DTSs, or whatever they're going to show it on.
Yeah.
And that's not black and white cinematography. It's the different thing, you know?
Yeah.
And when you see real black and white cinematography, you know what the difference is because it can, you know, you look at random Magnificent Ambersons or you suddenly, I mean, it's just this world that could not be captured in color. It's
just the velvety quality or what. An example I think of, which is sort of well past the standard black and white era, is something like HUD.
Yeah.
James Wong Howe's great cinematography. And not only the use of black and white, but the use of widescreen.
Sure.
Which, I mean, the two aren't often associated together.
It when they do, though.
Oh, yeah. Me too. And especially when it's done that well.
Yeah.
Where you feel like you're just on the Texas prairie with these people. And that black and white seems absolutely essential. And the only logical choice, like, of course this movie has to be in black and white.
Yeah, it makes no sense otherwise. Yeah, I can. It's funny how often, whenever I see a black and white movie that's Panavision or Scope, I just love the look of it, like The Haunting or The Innocence, or latter day, The Elephant Man.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is just a beautiful looking film, too, because that's real black and white cinematography as well. And it's a strange thing that I have nothing against technology. I like technology, and I like CGI when it's done to the service of the film.
Yes, exactly.
But nowadays, I feel like this is a rant I go on fairly regularly, so forgive me.
Rant away.
It seems to me that people use special effects as the sole criterion by which they judge whether a film is good or bad.
Yeah.
And they'll always say, well, I was watching Star Wars the other day and the special effects look so hokey. And I go, well, shut up. But also, this argument will only last for a little while because it's already starting to go. But I say, okay, you look at Wizard of Oz, made 75 years ago this year.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look at Oz the Great and Powerful, which has 75 more years of special effects wizardry to attach to it. Which movie do you want to watch again? Which movie do you love?
Which one are people still going to watch 75 years from now?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, which one has the better special effects?
Well,
I would say the first one does because it works for the film.
Well, you know, as a friend of mine who's a great moviegoer has said, because we have very similar conversations, and he says, you know, Matt, people go to the movies for all sorts of different reasons, and some of those reasons just aren't part of your world or my world.
Sure.
And it's true, because I would never go to a film simply because I hear the special effects are great. Yeah. I never would. And if it's in service to the story, I guess I'm putting story above effect. And a current example would be Gravity, which is, laden with special effects.
Sure.
But to me, they're absolutely essential, and they create this awesome environment in which to tell a really compelling human interest story.
Yeah, that story won't be told without those special effects.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's when effects get exciting, I think, because then the potential... Then the technology that's available to us right now is used in a really exciting way to tell a story that compels me both in my head and my heart. And, I'm not just going, wow, that was a hell of an explosion.
when it happens, when it's done well, it's done well.
Yeah.
I saw something on Facebook or somewhere maybe a year ago, and it was about the CGI used in Boardwalk Empire, which is a show I like very much.
Mm-hmm.
And it had never really occurred to me that virtually everything you see in that film is CGI. I mean, it's
almost
all of the boardwalk and all of the buildings and almost everything. And what really killed me was, do you watch the show?
I haven't seen it, no.
There's a character whose face was blown half off in the war.
I've seen clips of that character.
And he wears a mask on half his face. What I didn't realize was, because a couple of times he took the mask off and he's just got this empty eye socket.
Yeah.
And, the jaw is all messed up and you can see his teeth and it's just this mangled face. It wasn't makeup. It was CGI.
Right.
And it was all... And of course you think, well, of course you can't get an empty eye socket with makeup.
Right. Or it wouldn't look real.
There's no way to do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it had never occurred to me that because when I'm watching the story, I'm not taking myself out of it saying, gee, I wonder how they did that makeup effect or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Although I know a lot of people who do that, who keep themselves at arm's length of anything that they're watching.
By saying that doesn't look real.
Whatever they're saying.
Yeah,
they're just
some device to keep them from total involvement.
Yeah. They're just looking at the at the surface of the film and not... And to me, I just want to be in it and want to... And I often... people are always saying stuff, and I'm sure you get it too. They say, well, you're a film expert and you look at much deeper in movies. No, I don't.
I want to be entertained.
Yeah.
I want to get lost in it.
I want to know, oh, well, CGI certainly was not that much of a factor of the films that you cover in your new book, Roadshow. Those were cast of thousands, big, epic musicals that almost to a, well, you tell me, was there a success among any of them, or did they all tank?
There were successes, actually. I mean, if we're judging success primarily by profits and so forth. Yeah, there were. But just a little bit of background, the Roadshow is about the film musical from its sort of financial zenith with, you know, in a really narrow period of time of the release of Mary Poppins, My Fair Lady, and The Sound of Music into a kind of non-viable form by the early 70s. And I wanted to look at why that was, because since I was a kid, I was sort of fascinated by, you know, these references to a succession of musical bombs that had never really been looked at, you know, individual or collectively as say in a book form or anything. But now I forgot your question, Frank. Sorry. It was, okay. CGI.
Well, the point is with these things, they were, you know, you look at Hello Dolly or these films and they're gargantuan. There are thousands of people apparently on the set, and it is the last flowering of that kind of filmmaking.
Yes.
Before CGI. If you need thousands of people, you generate them. You don't hire them.
Right. Right.
But was, from what you were, the films that you mentioned, I mean, a little bit earlier was West Side Story, which of course was an enormous success. Mm-hmm. And then Mary Poppins, My Fair Lady, Sound of Music come along all in 64, 65. Were those films basically the death knell because they were so successful that it fooled everybody else into thinking that big musicals were going to be successful at the box office?
Yes, and that's the irony, if you will, of, you know, success bred failure.
Yeah.
or again, non-viability. That, and a few people knew that at the time, or there's a remarkable quote by Pauline Kael after The Sound of Music came out, in which she said, you know, these hugely successful musicals are going to, she didn't use these exact words, but in essence, she was saying they're going to bankrupt Hollywood because everybody's going to get on the bandwagon and try to replicate them. You know, it's the imitator effect, and they're not going to be as effective. She didn't like them as movies anyway, or very much. But apart from that, she said, you know, the habits of Hollywood are such that we're now going to see a lot of inferior, large scale, splashy musicals because the studios believe that that's what people want. And, you know, in the defense of the decision makers, it would certainly look that was the case.
Of course it did, yeah.
I mean, not only did you have those three, but you had also had the enormous success of A Hard Day's Night, which is, you know, a musical film of a sort, right? The Unsinkable Molly Brown, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg all came out in 1964. They're all highly musical films, doing very well. Earlier, you know, just a few years prior to that, was West Side Story and The Music Man. And so, yeah, studios had every reason to believe that these large-scale musicals were what people wanted. The tricky part, of course, is that they had to invest a great deal of money with the hopes of recouping a great deal of money. So it's a really high-risk game there, of a pretty high level of gambling and speculation in the movie industry. And in fact, they speculated wrong. And it wasn't what fascinated me about the whole phenomenon was it wasn't simply a misdiagnosis on the part of studio heads, but there are all these other factors, including a radical shift in society and taste and what audiences wanted to see and hear.
Yeah.
I remember your earlier question was, were there successes in this era? And there absolutely were. They're famous movies still today. Funny Girl made a lot of money in this period. Oliver, Fiddler on the Roof, and Cabaret.
Yeah.
So within the specific period I talk about, those four, actually Thoroughly Modern Millie made money as well, which is not as well known. And others were not huge bombs, but they were sort of break-even minor successes, but not enough to really maintain an enthusiasm for large-scale musicals. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, for example, was not a huge money loser, but neither was it a huge success.
It's probably, if you amortize it over the years, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang has probably done okay.
Yes, yes.
Just because it's constantly available on video and all that.
Well, and a lot of them that, that lost money in the short term actually ultimately broke even. But, you know, no studio wants to wait 25 years to balance the books, right?
Well, this is only judging from memory of seeing some of these films. And a lot of them I saw at the time and have never seen since. So it is going back. But when I think of The Sound of Music, it's not, in many ways, it's not a huge film. It was shot against these incredible backgrounds in Austria. So it's beautiful to look at. But it's not a cast of thousands mm-hmm. kind of film. It's a pretty intimate film thematically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And certainly the same thing could be said about Mary Poppins, which is all on sound stages at Disney.
Right. And about a small family.
Small family, not that many people involved.
Yeah.
And the same thing with My Fair Lady. There are a couple mm-hmm. of big set pieces at the ball and the Covent Gardens where all the flower people are. There are scenes where there might be 100 extras or something like that. But it is still a complete soundstage movie. They don't step outside the stage for a single shot, as far as I can recall.
Yeah, I think it's all
set. Yeah, all this stylized set. So even those films, well, I'm sure they were expensive because of all the various mm-hmm. things involved, but they weren't over the top.
Yeah.
Then you look at something like Funny Girl, which is bigger.
Mm-hmm.
You look at Hello, Dolly, which is
gargantuan. Yeah.
And every scene, it looks like Cleopatra. I mean, it's just thousands of
people. Cleopatra goes to Yonkers.
Yeah. And you think they must have just been thinking, if we keep making them bigger and splashier and louder, that people are going to love it more and more and more and more.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit hearkening back to our special effects thing of earlier, that it seems like a lot of people make movies and they think, if we can put more robots in it and mm-hmm, bigger explosions mm-hmm. and all, then people are just going to like them even more. But those films, I remember, I watched Hello, Dolly, but I could barely make it to the end of that thing.
Yeah.
I was out. And another thing is, I might be emblematic of why all these things were failing. Because I was a teenager at that time, and all that stuff started looking real stodgy to me.
Yes.
Like, it never would have occurred to me to go see Song of Norway or Lost Horizon or, I'd say, most of those things, mm-hmm. Dr. Doolittle.
Mm-hmm.
It never would have occurred to me to see any of that stuff. I'd go see all of it now. If a 70mm print came out, I would go see it.
And you're also a film historian.
Sure,
now,
yeah. But at the time, I was a teenager. And also, I mean, because as you say, this is also where, Woodstock is happening. And where, all of that is, that's where my attention was. And that's where I think most of my peers.
Well, it's great that you're an eyewitness to this very thing. And I was slightly younger, so I wasn't
decades younger.
Thank you. But I mean, I remember these films, but I was prepubescent when they were out. But the amazing disconnect between all this money being lavished on all these films with an effort. Studios had already identified that our prime target for, getting butts in seats are going to be people from 18 to 24. They've already defined the youth market, and they were making Camelot, and they were making Dr. Doolittle, and they were making Star. And, you have to say at one point, what were they thinking? Right. And then along come these little movies that nobody has any confidence in, like Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate, and The Lines Are Around the Block. And I mean, to hear you, all these years later say, yeah, I was of that age and I would not have been even slightly interested in these movies. I think that speaks for millions of others.
Whereas I remember every minute of seeing Bonnie and Clyde for the first time.
Oh, absolutely.
It was huge.
Absolutely.
And Easy Rider as well. Mm-hmm. It was a huge experience in my life.
Well, and the point I make in the book is that, and those films are referenced in this book, and I say, part of the excitement of writing Roadshow was saying, you know, these large scale musicals became extinct, basically. This is an evolutionary dead end, as far as I can tell. There are glimmers of it here and there since, but not really. There are no obvious successors to these films, unlike the deep influence that Bonnie and Clyde had, for example, on screen violence and so forth. But I love that about these, because I always feel like, well, when the history of 60s cinema is written, we talk about Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate and Easy Rider, and we should. I mean, they were seminal films. But we don't talk about these huge, big-budget things that just sat there in empty theaters that made a great deal to their studios, and they're sort of negative examples of what movies didn't become but were hugely important in their time. At least they were built up to be.
Yeah.
They were not public favorites, but I just felt like the history of 60s movies needs to include a more, you know, studied look at these great big white elephants.
Yeah. And it seems to me that they're not only musicals of the time, but a lot of those Roadshow films, it was a long death.
Yeah.
But it
ugly.
The gasping death knell happened for quite a few years. But even, you know, I remember Ryan's Daughter being the first David Lean film where I went, I don't know if I'm going to see it or not. You know, it just doesn't seem that interesting to me.
Well,
and there was a lot of that stuff going on.
Yes. And musicals were not the only form that was having this problem. Yeah. I mean, large scale historic epics were also being rejected by the public. I sort of think that height in terms of box office might have been, say, Dr. Zhivago in 65, not coincidentally the same year of The Sound of Music. But I chose to focus on musical roadshows because there were so many of them, and they seemed to really sort of summarize the problem with that kind of movie making at that time. But you have lots of large-scale historic epics that also didn't do well. The Agony and the Ecstasy, Shoes of the Fisherman. Into the early 70s, you have Nicholas and Alexandra and Young Winston and Cromwell. These are all huge historic epics that, you know, might actually be pretty good movies, but nobody was interested.
Yeah.
The last gasp of that kind of movie making.
I often think that because those kinds of films were the norm at the time, that audiences didn't see what was special about them. Because sometimes, every once in a while, there'll be a 70mm festival around here, and I'll go and I'll see something. Latest example of that was, this has been two or three years ago, but The Egyptian showed Lord Jim in 70mm, which I'd never seen. And always been curious about. And it's not a successful film entirely, but just the 70mm presentation of it, all of this stuff makes it a special experience to watch now.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think at the time, it was so normal to see those big things that people weren't even noticing that about them. And I think that was the same thing with these musicals because, you know, I wrote a book about Robert Wise, and Star was a big surprise to me because I thought it was pretty good and had some serious ideas in it. I didn't think it was entirely successful as a film, but once you get to that point, it becomes beside the point. It's irrelevant in a way.
Well,
you know,
in the case of the musicals, they simply saturated the market.
Yeah.
You know, they said, oh, everybody wants The Sound of Music. So they tried to give them 12 Sound of Musics per year. I mean, the output increased. Yeah. And so suddenly this supposed special experience isn't special anymore.
It's exactly what's happening in 1929 and 1930
with musicals.
With musicals. I mean, it's the same thing.
It's a very similar cycle going on.
They flood the market because everybody loves musicals, right? Nope, they don't. They get tired of them. I mean, and that was, I think, part of this as well. And also, you know, this is also coming at the time, TV had already been around for a long time, but it had, even in the 50s, with as popular as television was, it didn't really seriously erode the movie-going audience like in the 60s was happening. I mean, it seemed like more and more and more people were becoming used to TV as their main source of entertainment. Mm-hmm. And I believe that Hollywood was as they did in the early 50s, give them big stuff, give them CinemaScope, give them 70 millimeter, something they cannot see
right
at home.
This is how we...
It seems like it should work.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's, it's interesting how you bring that up, because I think the fear of television was paralyzing to movie makers in the 50s. But I'm not sure that it was actually a direct threat the way it was in the 60s. I mean, if TV viewership indeed increased by then. It's an interesting point, because it seems like the early 60s, I mean, in the reading and sort of research I did, is that the early 60s was really the trough. That movie going was actually down even from the late 50s.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I was looking, you know, thinking about movie genres that, you know, the sort of tried and true way of getting people in. And Westerns weren't really doing well in the early 60s, because you had the aging of John Wayne and mm-hmm. Randolph Scott. And so,
and nobody
career,
was taking their
right?
places, no.
And, right. And there wasn't, you know, there weren't exciting new Western stars, maybe on television and Rawhide or Bonanza, but not on the big screen. Film noir had sort of, exhausted itself in its early form, you know, by the late 50s. It was something else, perhaps. And apparently movie attendance was way down in the early 60s. And that was the period where studios had reason to fear the threat of television, perhaps.
Yeah.
Maybe even more than the 60s. And that, or 50s. And that just compounds the impact that these musicals had, perhaps, on people's thinking about what should get made. Like, this is the savior of our industry. Big, splashy, family-friendly musicals. Yeah, the bigger, the better. Yeah.
It's funny. We got our first color TV. I think I was probably 14 or 15, something like that. Much later than many of my friends had their color TVs. But when we finally got it, it's impossible to explain to someone mm-hmm. now who did not grow up without color.
Yeah.
How huge it was.
It's true.
Huge it was. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the first time when it started seeming as much fun to stay home and watch TV as it would be to go to a movie. Now, when I became a later teenager, it became more fun to go to drive-ins, but that mm-hmm. had nothing to do with the
well,
movie.
Yeah, right. It was like drive-ins, yeah. That's a separate category.
So whatever I saw at a drive-in, I only kind of saw.
Yeah, right.
But I think a lot of that works in with these things too. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, you were watching these, which ones did you think really got the shaft from being lumped in with these? Which ones did you think was really good?
Well, you know, I was watching for that. I thought, you know, am I going to find some forgotten jewel among these movies that, you know, that really was just a victim of bad timing, but it's actually really a wonderful film and deserves rediscovery. And I can't really say that I found that. I mean, I almost would say that their reputations are deserved, or, you know, so far in their history, right? The one that I would say really does have quite a bit of merit and didn't deserve its very low box office was Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
Yeah,
the musical version, which has some really good things about it, but some really unfortunate choices, I think, in terms of popularity.
Sure.
But and that's the thing about every single one of these films, maybe with a couple of exceptions, have some really good things in them. I mean, they have good production numbers. They have good. Usually, it's musically that they got, you know, this number just right, with the right talent and the right music. But there's so much around it that seems to have been miscalculated. I'm thinking of actually one example would be Paint Your Wagon, which I'm finding is, now that this book is out, people love to cite Paint Your Wagon as the example of what not to do, right?
And I don't agree
everything
with that.
That was wrong. And I don't necessarily agree
either. I don't agree
either,
with that either. No.
But it is proving to be the whipping boy of the movies that I
It's the whipping boy because... Clint Eastwood sings in it.
Right.
And everybody just assumes that's an absurdity.
Right.
And I think most people who assume that didn't bother to see the film. They just think, oh, that's mm-hmm. one of those weird things that he should not have done. Like Marlon Brando in Guys and Dolls, when in fact he's fine in Guys and Dolls.
You know? Yeah, I mean, Eastwood's actually, his singing is not well-trained or anything, but it's
fine, yeah.
It's acceptable, it's, yeah. you know.
If it were anybody else giving the exact performance,
right.
you wouldn't think twice about
right.
it. Yeah.
And I think the problems of that movie are maybe less the singing of both Clint Eastwood and Lee Marvin, and more just... problems with the direction and yeah. the sort of lack of control that appeared to be going on in the mounting of the production numbers and things like that. But actually there's, you might remember Wandering Star from sure. Pincher Wagon, which got, people just, you know, got so creative in how they could, you know, talk about how terrible Lee Marvin's voice was. You know, it sounds like a cement mixer and, you know, broken glass and, you know, on and on and on. And you watch Wandering Star today, and, you know, I had to say my honest response is I think it's a pretty effective number. It really develops his character. There's a kind of
yeah.
melancholy about it, but also a resignation of this is the kind of guy I am. I don't stay in one place for very long. And there's a wonderful, rich male chorus that's supporting him as he sings it. And it's good.
Yeah.
It's actually good. And it's just too bad that all this other stuff has to sort of drag down these stronger moments. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if you deal with this in the book. But here's a theory that I have, and maybe it's common. I've never heard anybody else say it, but maybe I didn't invent it. But I think one of the reasons that musicals started falling off so quickly is that the divergence between the kind of music that people were listening to and the kind of music that was in musicals kept getting wider and wider and wider. When you watched, if you were in 1935 and went to see Top Hat,
mm-hmm.
the music that you heard would be pretty much the records that you were buying
mm-hmm.
if right. you liked popular music.
Right.
No real One difference between all
yeah.
the same.
Complete synthesis. Yeah. yeah.
But if I go see A Hard Day's Night one day and Mary Poppins the next day, uh-huh. which I could have
right,
and didn't, I never saw Mary Poppins for years because it just seemed, I took one look at it and went, nah.
That's not for me. Even though that one was huge, yeah. but yeah.
Hard Day's Night, I saw it repeatedly. And, but the music, you know, when I did go see those musicals, I was a little bit more broad-minded than some of my friends because I liked musicals. You know, I had the soundtrack to The Unsinkable Molly Brown, and, you know, I was obsessed with West Side Story, just obsessed yeah, well. With it. And, but it was not anything like, and so I think that's part of it. It's a different kind of thing.
Frank, I think if you had written this book, it would have sounded an awful lot like mine because I mean that I cover that as well. And Good. And it's been suggested that big split really happened with rock and roll.
Sure.
That popular music and show music really diverged.
Yeah.
And have yet to really be fully reunited in like highly popular musical films or anything. But yeah, and when I think about the comparisons and the vibrancy of music, you know, of that era. I used the example of 1967, and you have Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. You have Motown doing amazing stuff.
Sure.
You have the Stones. You have Dylan. And Warner Brothers is prepping Camelot, and Fox is prepping Dr. Dolittle.
Yeah.
I mean, there yeah. you go, right there.
yeah. Yeah, no Motown fan is yeah. going to go see Dr. Dolittle.
Right. And
not going to happen, you know?
We now know, and yeah. I think it would have been obvious at the time also, is that music, you know, the popular music was indeed very, very popular.
Yeah.
So, but nobody seemed to get the idea of uniting that with high-budget films and really capitalizing on these fresh new sounds. And that's another factor in the book that has to do with the the aging of the executives. I mean, Daryl Zanuck's still in control.
Sure.
And Jack Warner's still in control. And they have very different ideas about what they think and what they're sure that the public wants.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, their instincts and their extraordinary experience actually didn't really work anymore. I mean,
sure.
they really were out of touch, dare I say, towards the end of their careers.
Yeah. They were not listening to that music. Weren't going listening to Motown music.
Right.
I can't imagine Harry Warner doing it.
I sympathize. You know, I mean, if I was their age and I was making those decisions, I'm not sure that I would tap into what 18-year-olds today want to hear.
Well, sure. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'd make a lot of mistakes.
I listen to music a lot and love music and try my best to sift through new music to find people that I like, and I do mm-hmm. find people. But your point is well taken. If somebody said to me, make a movie that will appeal to 18-year-olds with music that would appeal to them, I wouldn't know what to do.
Yeah.
Because I can think of things that they like that I also like, but there's not that many of those things. But more important, I'm not 18, and I don't mm-hmm. hang around with 18-year-olds, you know.
But it does and feel, so, I mean, the rock and roll speculation, that's where it really...
Yeah.
They went in opposing directions or contrary directions. I think there might be something to that. I mean, and maybe it's my myth-making in my head that once upon a time, families, you know, mom, dad, and the kids could be all the way to 18, were happily all going to the movies together. And there were products out there that appealed to everybody. It feels like somewhere around the 60s, if that scenario was ever, you know, viable in American public, it pretty much went away at that point. I mean, as a kid, I remember, you know, arguments that my parents would have with my older siblings about, no, you can't go see that. That's rated R or, you know, whatever. That's, which I actually, I'm digressing a bit, but I do remember that my mother in the 30s was having conversations with her mother saying, no, you can see Irene Dunne movies because she was a lady.
Yeah.
But you can't see Jean Harlow movies because she's a little, you know.
Sure.
So maybe it wasn't that different.
Yeah, she ices her nipples, you know. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I think you start seeing it in the movies of the 40s. The youth divergence starts happening, not really Mickey and Judy, but around that time, there's a lot more... Well, I guess Mickey and Judy would work because there's a lot more of, hey, we don't want to listen to our parents' music. We got this new mm-hmm. swing and we're, mm-hmm. and so the split is starting to happen
yeah.
in the 40s. After the Second War, that really starts to happen. And then by the 50s, it's done.
It's just like yeah. the split is so huge. Yeah, yeah. Irreconcilable. Yeah.
Yeah. And, but, there was still enough of an audience. I mean, certainly West Side Story added to the fact that it's one of the greatest musical scores anybody yeah. ever wrote.
Yeah.
So it transcends style in a way because, I mean, or genre. But when you think of all these 60s musicals, only Bye Bye Birdie seems to mm-hmm. try to address mm-hmm. the popular music
That's
of its
true.
Time.
Yeah. Interesting in it with Paint Your Wagon is that there was an attempt, not so much with the music, but with the marketing of that film to appeal to youth. But you look back on it now and you say it was really not well executed in an effort to do that. I mean, they hired the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band to do some stuff with the film, and they used sort of Peter Mac style, bright colors in their marketing. And the storyline that had been adapted from the Broadway original, which it was not in the original, included polyandry or, you know, two husbands and one wife.
Yeah.
That you know, Eastwood and Marvin are sharing Jean Seberg as a wife. And then they tried to market that as, these are just hippies exercising free love back during the gold rush.
Sure.
And so they really made these sort of ham-fisted attempts to appeal to youth. And that actually sets Paint Your Wagon apart because some of these other films just seem to be blind to younger audiences. Yeah. But when Paint Your Wagon tried, they didn't really do it very well in terms of marketing.
Well, you know, when I was growing up, Disney films were just a necessity. Whatever mm-hmm. Disney film came mm-hmm. to town, I would see it. And in fact, I've often thought that probably the most influential period of my life was when I was about 7 or 8 and saw just this remarkable string of films from Disney. Pollyanna,
yes.
Kidnapped, Darby O'Gill and the Little People.
Swiss Family Robinson.
Swiss Family Robinson.
Yeah.
All these.
A remarkable run.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Terrific films with real drama.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Darby O'Gill, real horror. Funny parts, sad parts.
Life lessons.
Yeah. And.
You know? Old Yeller, you know, a child has to come to terms with the yeah. reality of death.
And yeah, all of that stuff was hugely important to me. But by the mid-60s, and I was still just barely turning into a teenager at that time, but already the Disney film started thinking like, oh, geez. No.
Yeah.
And Happiest Millionaire, you couldn't have paid me to go see
yeah.
that movie.
Yeah.
You just, everything about that screamed, stay away. And
well, you and millions of others.
Yeah. And so I think that's why I think that for some reason I was, you know, I think we all like to think of ourselves as special. And every once in a while I think, you know, I'm kind of a different kind of, but I'm not. I'm exactly like everybody right. else.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah.
And in that period of history, I was with the majority of American people, I think, you know.
Yeah. That's what makes your observations of this stuff so valuable. I should have interviewed you before I wrote it, actually. But in the case of The Happiest Millionaire, you know, all of those things that you're talking about with the early 60s Disney movies, which really do give them substance and
yeah.
weight. I remember the first time I saw Pollyanna, I was devastated
yeah.
at what happened.
And she's not cured at the end.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
I was a kid and I was saying, wait, this is Disney. This is,
yeah.
what? This is, I can't believe this is happening, right? But of course, I realize that enriches that
sure
film immeasurably. And it looks that you can detect something of a formula. Like Disney's going to do some relatively hard-hitting stuff here that their reputation is not entirely consistent with what's going to go on in these movies. Like, you're going to have to deal with some drama here.
Yeah, they're going to take you seriously as an audience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Even if we're talking about
yeah.
underage kids who are going to be watching this. And in the case of The Happiest Millionaire, there's none of that.
No.
It's just people with painted-on smiles.
It's meringue.
It's, yeah. Well, it's even lighter than meringue.
Yes.
I mean, it's just like it's nothing.
Yeah.
I think I used the word dross. I mean, it's just.
Yeah.
It's
I saw
helium.
It later. I worked with Disney in the non-theatrical office in Chicago for a couple of years. And so I watched a lot of stuff then that I'd never gotten around to seeing. And I watched Happiest Millionaire. And I was just aghast throughout it. It's just awful.
Well, and it really does become a sort of a primary example in the book because it was so obviously modeled after the success of Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
You know, it has the widescreen, it has the big budget, it's a musical, it's meant to make you feel good, it's going to grab the family the way Mary Poppins did, and literature I found on it, all the background was very much we're positioning this as the next Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
And it, of course, wasn't. And Disney never tried anything quite like that again. They did do other non-roadshow musicals like the one and only Original Family Band. And I'm drawing a blank. There was another one. I think it also had Leslie Ann Warren and John Davidson. And
The Gnomemobile had music in it, but it wasn't really a musical.
But they were more modestly budgeted than Happiest Millionaire and,
yeah.
and a little bit more realistic in their, you know, what they were hoping to, I think, recoup. But everybody thought Happiest Millionaire was going to be, you know, the new record
yeah.
breaker.
Well, it's, I guess when you sum it up, the films that you deal with in your book Roadshow, don't they point toward what Hollywood was going to become? I mean, as the 70s come along, it's almost like this is a total rejection of what was happening in those films.
Mm-hmm.
So really one of the richest periods in film history is the first half of the 70s.
Yeah.
Oh. It's just a remarkable period of film.
Cue the Yeah. Celestial Choir. I love the early 70s.
And but I mean, talk about serious films and films that had dark points to make. A lot of that had to be a rejection of this froth that was happening in these films, right?
It feels like not only a pendulum swing, but a pendulum spasm. I mean, it seems to be a really dramatic rejection.
Yeah.
And you know, the different interpretations of that has been, you know, the corporate histories of Hollywood at that time were completely convoluted because you have the buying of the studios by conglomerates at this period and fast personnel changes. And one account that I found was that there weren't executives staying in executive positions long enough to oversee films that were, say, now being shot on location instead of the backlots because the backlots were all sold, right? Yeah. So you have mavericks like Robert Altman and Martin Scorsese and Bogdanovich, you know, at the beginnings of their careers, being given a budget and then saying, okay, go off and make your movies, but not a lot of oversight relative to, you know, once the corporate empire is solidified again with the you know, the conglomeratization of the studios. And that was in part account for this very rich period of films that really seem to be the product of, sounds pretentious perhaps, directorial vision.
Yeah.
As opposed to studio or studio interference.
Well, the 60s in general seemed to be, I mean, there's certainly a lot of great stuff that happened in the 60s, a lot. And that's a different podcast. But right now we're talking about the lousy stuff of the 60s.
Right.
And it seemed to me, as you know, an early teenager to a mid-teenager, which is what I was then, every time a Hollywood movie tried to depict current youth, it always seemed absurd because they didn't get it.
Right.
You know, The Impossible Years or The Strawberry Statement or any of those kind of films that tried to hit, you know, you'd always have people with, you know, fur vest and carrying protest signs. And and that's what they thought
was.
And so I think it ties in a little bit with these musicals. What you were saying earlier is that the studio heads were more increasingly out of touch with what was actually happening in the world.
Yeah.
And didn't know. And every once in a while they thought, oh, this youth market is big. We gotta hit that.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't know how to hit it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Even in, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which has its own weird problems, but you know, there's just this generic hippie guy that shows up and, you know, just walks
that's
in
such a strange
groovy,
scene.
You know, it's,
like,
yeah.
What
it's,
is that?
Yeah. And it's, you know, you can hear somebody in a meeting saying, you know, the kids are going to really want to see one of their own, you know. And
but doesn't he also function as a way of pointing out how Hepburn and Tracy are so out of touch?
Yeah.
Like here's this youth that's coming up and the elders just have no connection,
exactly.
No clue. It's foreign territory.
Yeah.
So, but it's very awkward. Yeah.
Tracy's actually playing Jack Warner in that.
Yes, exactly. I do believe so.
Well, the book, everybody should read this because it's really a fascinating period. And you're a great writer. I have all of your other books. And
well,
you just
want
to, yeah, I really admire your work a lot, as you well know. So,
well, likewise, Frank.
And so, Roadshow with an exclamation point is your next book purchase. And I'm telling this to all five of my listeners. So in my world, if five people bought my book, it would double the sales.
Maybe six or seven. I might talk a few friends into
all right.
Listening. Yeah.
That's why I get popular people on here. So, well, thanks very much, Matt. This has been so much fun to me. I kept you
it's
much
been great.
Longer.
It's, you know, it's such a joy to talk with somebody who's so well-versed and personable and... I feel like we could go on for another 48 hours.
Let's do it.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We'll do it again one of these days.
I look forward to it.
I sure hope you enjoyed that talk with Matthew Kennedy. If you, for some reason, listened to this one first, please go back and listen to part one. It was all good fun. I plan on having Matt on the show again. And if it's up to me, I'll have him on again and again, because I really enjoy talking to him. Great, great fun. And get this book, Roadshow, The Fall of Film Musicals in the 1960s. And here's how you get such a book. Go to my website, thecommentarytrack.com, click on the Amazon link, go through and order there. That means Matt gets a sale and I get a little kickback from Amazon. That's what I call win-win. Isn't that wonderful? I want to thank my wonderful wife, Claire McCullough, for being my announcer. I want to thank James Hutchins for designing my websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. Also, Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing my wonderful and beautiful theme music, both fore and aft. And I want to thank you, the listener, my friends. And I say my friends like the little girl in Curse of the Cat People says, my friend. Because you're sharing this podcast with others. You're telling others to leave nice reviews and 5-star ratings on iTunes. You're spreading the word on Facebook and Twitter. Actually, I don't think any of you is doing any of that stuff. So I'm begging you to do it, though, to do all of it, because I really would love to build an audience beyond the audience that we have now. I could have a reunion of all of my audience members in my tiny bungalow, and we'd still have a couple of rooms left over. So I'm begging you. Nah, I'm asking politely. I would offer a bribe if I had anything to bribe you with, but I have nothing. I'm standing here holding my pockets outside my pants like a guy in a cartoon, showing that I have nothing to offer but my podcast. So please help me out if you can. Got another great one coming up next time. And in the meantime, don't worry, we'll fix it in post.